listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb in today. Going to tell you about Tom's book tour in a second, but we do have a guest on the line, and he was on with us just within the last few weeks. His name is C. Edmund Wright. He is a conservative commentator, contributor to Breitbart, an American thinker, and also author of WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. So without further ado, let's welcome back our good friend to the program, C. Edmund Wright. Welcome, Edmund.
Hey, Mike. How are you, man? And I guess Karl Rove probably agrees on you and I, so how about that?
There you have it. Well, that's, we're always seeking common ground. Eventually, I think America will get to that point, but it seems like we're a far, far way away at this particular time. But in any case, C. Edmund, today we wanted to talk about the actual Oregon's talking about paid sick leave, and wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. I know there's some speculation that they might be able to get this at a statewide level. Certain cities throughout the country right now have been successful in implementing paid sick leave. Certain other jurisdictions are looking into it. Other statewide levels, statewide initiatives are underway. So we wanted to hear from your perspective. Good idea, bad idea, you know, what do you think?
Well, a couple of things here, Mike. First of all, I'm in favor of sick leave. I just think it ought to be what the company uses as a benefit, or what they use as a recruiting tool. Now, I will also say that in a situation like this, I think it's offensive when the federal government mandates it, because I just don't like central planning. I think it's a little less offensive if a state does it, and even less offensive if a city does it, because again, the you have local jurisdiction there. But I would say this: there is a company in our area, the Research Triangle of North Carolina. It's been like the best place in America to work most of the last 15 years. It's called SAS Institute, S-A-S. You can Google it. It's a high-tech firm, extremely successful, and they have the best benefits in the nation. The point is, Mike, when they started, they were so poor when they started, they couldn't have any sick leave. They had no health care. The only benefit they had was M&M's on Wednesday. I mean, this is how they started. Had they had to pay for benefits in the early days, they might not exist today. And yet for almost two decades, they have been a fabulous place to work. So that is why I don't want government making these decisions. But I'm all in favor of a progressive company like Costco, for example, that has great benefits, using that to recruit employees versus Target and Walmart, et cetera.
All right, well, let me ask you this. So one of the things you said you don't like is central planning. So elaborate on that a little, see, I mean, because, I mean, basically, to me, that really is the crux of the matter here, is that you are sort of positing that if a company or a business knew ahead of time kind of what the ground rules were, that somehow or another that would inhibit them. But I have to say I'm on the opposite side of this. I think that central planning is a good thing, and that allows the businesses to make decisions in a very structured, pragmatic way, because they know basically what their financial requirements are going to be to run the business.
Mike, what you don't understand about starting a business for a lot of people is that they are not – so many businesses today that are mega successful – were just started when some guy had a great idea in the shower or when he woke up or something. And he just started with an idea, and he didn't know what the government rules and regulations were, and he sort of rambled his way through and made it work. And now many of those companies are major employers, major employers with thousands of employees and, you know, rich stockholders, and everybody wins. And of course, a lot of companies start that way and don't make it as well. Startups are an extremely difficult thing to do.
Sure.
Many of them don't make it, and Mike, it's government regulations that keep many of them from making it.
All right, and I don't disagree. Look, I don't disagree with you on that premise. I mean, look, you know, I'm an entrepreneur myself. You know, I have started many businesses, a physician. I've done.
But let me ask you something.
Yes.
Because I hear this. I hear a lot of lawyers and attorneys and high tech people and ad agencies and other things talk about they've run a business before, and I get that. Those are legitimate businesses. But the financial realities of a white-collar business with white-collar people working is entirely different from a business where you have one suit and everyone else is blue-collar. There's an entirely different...
No. I agree with you. Look, I'm a physician, and I started a national hospitalist company where, you know, all my workers are practically white-collar workers. I mean, they were all doctors.
That's a much easier thing to do than a blue-collar situation when it comes to forced mandates and benefits from government, because a hospital's revenue stream, as you know, involves many tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars per employee, because you have a high level of employee. That's different from a factory where their entire revenue stream may just be $30 an hour per, you know, floor employee.
No, I understand that. But so let me ask you this, because what they did in Oregon I thought was interesting. I don't know if you saw the article, but they tried to create some kind of ground rules, and they said in the law that Portland, Oregon passed, the city, Portland, Oregon, they said that if you have six or more employees in the company, so it's not even – if you're an entrepreneur, you don't have to worry about that. If it's six or more in the company, at least 5 days of paid sick days per year for full-time workers, and those with five or fewer employees, they would have to offer leave, but unpaid leave. So that was what Oregon did. What do you think about those kind of ground rules?
But, you know, I would not vote for that kind of ground rule, but I have to tell you that is so – almost benign that it would not bother me. I think that any businessman who wants to keep his employees, and most business owners really do want to keep their employees if they're any good. I mean, they're not that easy to find good employees, especially in certain parts of the country in certain industries. I think that the business people that are really interested in keeping good employees probably already have crossed that bar inside their own businesses. So my answer would be, I just am against government telling private businesses and private employees anything about their relationship, but this is not a hill I would die on. Fair enough?
All right. No, I understand. But let's get back to this thing about government, because that always seems to be the contention, at least when you and I have spoken, is that you have this aversion of the government and the private sector somehow or another kind of collaborating. Because in essence, what they're doing in this particular article that I talked about, it wasn't just government unilaterally, as you had I'd seen at least in the one-point memo, you're concerned about government ramming things down people's throats. But it was the government. It was 15 lawmakers. They had business representatives, unions, advocates, everybody meeting every month to discuss a potential bill that would guarantee state workers access to paid sick leave. So it wasn't just like the government operating in a vacuum. See, I mean, it was like the community, you know, lawmakers and representatives and unions and workers all trying to say, okay, what's the solution? So I guess my question to you is, why do you feel that government can never work collaboratively with the private sector and the free market? Why does it have to exist independent of? Why can't it work in conjunction with?
Well, and I wouldn't say never, but I would say usually. And I would also say, under the scenario that you just described, and this is in your part of the country, and so I have to trust you know what you're talking about with this specific bill. And
this is in Oregon, effort. Yeah.
Okay. See, I am against the federal government. I am against centralized control. What you showed there is a situation where the locals worked it out, and Portland did not require, the entire state of Oregon to agree, and they didn't require Washington, D.C. to agree. So when it comes to local government, I still, in general, believe that less is more. However, it sounds like this is a situation where the local government did not ramrod things through. You know, the best form of government, and I'll use the show Andy Griffith. See, if Floyd had a problem with local government, he just walked down to Andy's office and the mayor and the sheriff, and they worked it out. That's actually the best kind of government, as opposed to some bureaucrat somewhere that was set up by some congressman in Washington, and you're 2,800 miles away in Portland, and you can't do anything about the government that's ruining your life. But it sounds like this was a different situation.
Well, it was a different situation, but I would beg to differ on the fact that you can't do anything about it, because representatives at the federal level, you can change them every 2 years, senators every six, and president every four. So it's government's supposed to reflect we the people, and we always have an opportunity to do that. See, Evan, thank you so much for your time on the air today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a second. Stay with us.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Tom Hartman is at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, noon to 2 today. Go check him out. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. As Tom had said, he will be today from noon to 2 at the Commonwealth Club, 595 Market Street in San Francisco, California. And then tomorrow, Friday, which would be, which date, Eric? November
22nd.
Very good. And he'll be at Powell's Bookstore, and that'll be at 1005 West Burnside Street in Portland, Oregon, where we just spoke, Eric, about Portland actually creating legislation, laws, that have paid sick leave. I don't think that's a bad thing, to be honest with you. I don't think it's a bad thing for a government to say, hey, businesses, let's work together collaboratively. Let's value your employee. And when they get sick, let's give them, you know, they're not giving you infinite days. You can't be sick for,
right.
You know.
Like I was.
Right. Well, you were very sick. You had surgery. But the point is, at least, you know, you're giving people, in this case, if it's six or more employees, they have to give them 5 paid sick days a year if they're full-time employees. I mean, that doesn't sound too unreasonable. What do you think?
I think that's pretty reasonable.
It sounds pretty reasonable. And then if you had 5 or fewer employees, then you don't have to pay them, but you still have to give them unpaid sick leave at least for 5 days as well.
Right. You can't fire them because they get sick.
Right, because you get sick. So, I mean, look, I don't think that's a bad thing. And I know we were just – let me give you the Freedom Lines, and then people can hop on board and discuss this topic with us. 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. Just give us a shout if you want to participate in this discussion. But it goes back to the basic thing, the theme of yesterday's program, Eric, when we were talking about – you know, minimum wage, and we were talking about livable
wage. Valuing your employees.
Yeah, about valuing your employee. This is sort of the continuation of that discussion
yesterday.
Happy
workers make good, you know, they're productive.
They're productive, and I think they make part of a good company, because when you value your worker and you say, look, you mean something to me. You're not just sort of a line item on my expense side of my financial statement. You're actually somebody who has thoughts and feelings, and you have your own life, and you have children perhaps, and a spouse or a significant other, and I want to sort of invest in you too to make sure that you are happy and that you are well and that you feel comfortable working in this particular environment, and that if for some reason or another, things that we cannot predict in life, we all come upon things that, you know, just pop out of the blue. You didn't expect to be waking up on the floor that day and
no.
Your belly was hard as a rock and you were in exquisite pain and you're calling me up, what the hell do I do? And, you know, and then you end up in a hospital with major surgery. I mean, you just can't, you don't plan for those things. I mean, they happen. And, you know, it's nice to know that it's part of your job that if something catastrophic and unforeseen were to occur, that guess what? Your employer, to a certain extent, has got your back. Okay. And that's a nice feeling. I mean, I would think everybody would like to work for an employer in that kind of environment where, you know, hey, if I get sick, I don't have to worry about missing work for a week or two because I got sort of insurance in the sense that I'm going to get paid for that week or two. And I think that helps you heal better too, Eric. I think if you're sick.
You don't want the stress, trust me.
Like, you know, you're thinking, boy, you know, I'm not going to be at work now for another 2-3 days and I'm going to lose that income and I got this bill to pay. And
I can relax and get better.
Right. You can relax. The body can say, okay, that's one less thing to stress about. And look, and as a doctor, I would definitely argue that that does help the healing process, Eric, because anytime you're stressed, you know, you have a neuroendocrine system in your body, basically, where you have chemicals, hormones that are released into your bloodstream that when you're stressed, those hormones are not good for you. Those actual chemicals, whether it's like norepinephrine or something that revs up your body, revs up your system, puts it into overdrive, you don't need that in your body. Sometimes you need to kind of heal and let the body maintain a certain equilibrium. But if you're having all this stress because, hey, I got to get back to work, I got to get back to work, I got to get back to work, I got to get my paycheck, then one, your body's not going to heal. Two, if you go back to work prematurely and you didn't take the proper time for your body to heal, then you're just going to end up not only continuing to be sick, but maybe worse off
right.
than you were when you started. So I think it's a phenomenal thing. And when any time where I differ with C. Edmund Wright is this, is that I don't think government is just this big, evil, non-accountable monster. You know, that's obviously what many conservatives, many conservative Republicans, and many libertarians think about government. But when I think of government, Eric, I really do think – I get excited about government. I really do. I think, you know what? This was a great creation by our founding fathers. I mean, what – look, you can have communism, right? You can have the Politburo if you want. You can go to China and, you know, have the way they do things over there. You know, or you can have the government here where at least, you know, as I said earlier to C. Edmund Wright – if you don't like your official, if you don't like your representative in 2 years, vote him out. I mean, when conservative Republicans and libertarians act as though that there's no way out, that it's just this thing that's going to exist forever and ever and ever, and it's just a cancer that'll never go away. I disagree. The beauty of the Founding Fathers was such that, hey, if you don't like the representative, and if they're passing paid sick days and passing it into law where an employer now is obligated to actually pay for 5 or 6 days, that was my outlook. I have it open. Don't worry about it.
Distracting, Mike.
No. It just meant it was a good thought. That's all. It was my mind. I had a little light go off in my mind. But in any case, if they're paying, if you're getting paid sick days and the government passed that law, and now it's mandated for employers of certain number of where the business has a certain number of employees, et cetera. If you don't like that, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to be like that forever. You could petition your government. You could seek redress. You could sign up to vote, and you can participate in an election. You can get, you know, a campaign afoot. You can go to other people. You can go to activists, and you can vote in the election. And that official, you could send them home packing. And that's the beauty of it. It doesn't, again, as I say, exist in a vacuum. There are ways to redress the government. There are ways to seek grievances, and there are ways to put people that have your belief system into office, and that they will reflect that. That's what's called the will of the people. That's what's called a representative democracy. So I never really understand why conservative Republicans and why libertarians feel as though government is this evil thing. I think government is a beautiful thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. And the fact that I can participate in my government just gives me tingles, to be honest with you. You know, go try to participate in the private sector at a board meeting. See if you can get into that. So if you're a shareholder and you have $10 a stock at, Microsoft, try to get into the board meeting and have your viewpoint reflected. Versus you can do that by voting. Anybody can vote. Everybody can vote. And that's why ultimately the government gives you more of an opportunity to have a say.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The Crash of 2016 by Tom Hartman. Check it out at the finest bookstores across America. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike sitting in today. Let's go to Leonard. We got the phone lines packed right now at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let's continue this discussion. Leonard's on the line from Riegelwood, North Carolina. Welcome, Leonard.
Thank you. I was going to comment on the conservative commentator you had on there, Mr. Wright.
Correct. Mr. Wrong.
Yeah, that would be a good metaphor. I was thinking of what he was talking about, and I don't know if I'm entirely disagreeing with him on startup companies, but he seemed to be depending on them. Once they're up and running, they'll do the right thing. And I would point out to him that if it takes a look at Walmart, you know, and I read John Walton's book, How He Started, but I look at where he's at today, where his company's at today, and look at the, how they do their employees today. So every company that's up and running and doing well is not going to do right by their employees. And Walmart's a prime example.
No, I think that's an excellent point, Leonard, because you're right. Here you got one of the richest companies and one of the companies in America that employs a lot of people. I mean, I'm sure they rank up there with the number of employees that they have. But you're correct. Did they do the right thing? You know, the Portland, Oregon law just said once you get past 6 employees, you should at least give them 5 days of paid sick leave. And that's just with 6 employees. I mean, I'm sure Walmart has, you know, tens of thousands of employees nationwide, but have they offered that same sick leave to their employees? And the answer is no. As far as I understand, they have not offered any type of comprehensive sick leave benefit package. So this is my whole point, Leonard. This is why when they say, oh, we don't want government ramming things down people's throats. But the point is, when the private sector doesn't respond to the market need, then guess what? The government and we the people, because we elect these officials, we have a right to step in and participate in our democracy and say, look, we want these rules and regulations in effect so that the private sector, that the free market plays fairly and doesn't try to bend the rules so that it disproportionately benefits them and everybody else has to suffer. So I agree, Leonard. Thanks a lot, and I appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, there you have it. That's Leonard. He opens up another freedom line here, so let's get to more callers. Let's go to Dave. Dave is listening on WCPT in Chicago, Illinois. Dave, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well.
I find it interesting when Republicans or libertarians talk about we don't like this law from the federal government. You never hear them talking about the subsidies to oil, gas, or farm companies, which, geez, if you got rid of those subsidies, you could pay for the health care program easily.
Yeah, well, they like those subsidies. Those are good subsidies in their eyes.
Like Walmart. Walmart, who doesn't pay their people enough so that they have to live on food stamps, that's a hidden subsidy to Walmart.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. I mean, if Walmart is keeping people part-time or to the point where they're not offering good benefits and the employee can't afford those benefits, they make so little money that even I think if you're working full-time at some of these Walmarts, you would still be able to qualify for Medicaid health insurance at certain state levels. Like I know, for instance, here in Arizona, there are many people who work at Walmart here in Arizona, but they don't make a livable wage, and then they qualify based off of their income level to get Medicaid, which is called Access here, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. So they're getting their health benefits from the taxpayers, from you and me and everybody else, but yet Walmart is getting off scot-free because they don't have to pay that benefit.
Yeah, that's a subsidy to Walmart.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an indirect subsidy, but a subsidy nonetheless, right, versus if it were mandated that they would have to actually give those benefits to their workers, then there'd be no loophole around it. They'd have to do that. And that's the whole point, is that where I disagree with CMN Wright is that if we, the people, see in the free market that they are playing by different sets of rules and regulations such that they disproportionately benefit from that at the expense of the taxpayer, then we, the taxpayer, have every right under our democracy, under our Constitution, under what the founding fathers envisioned, to seek redress, to seek grievances, and say to the private sector that, no, through our elected officials, through the democratic process, we're going to implement this law, we're going to vote on it, and it's going to become law. And if you don't like the law, if you think it's just some bureaucrat sitting in Washington, D.C., then guess what? Get up off your ass, get out there, vote, and then participate in democracy, put a different elected official in, and then get the law changed. But until such time, don't whine and poo-poo about how you hate government, how government is so evil. This is America. This is what our government is. If you don't like our government, then get the hell out of the country. Leave. Go somewhere else. If there's another country that you like that has a better government and a better structure, then leave. You know, but don't complain about how bad our government is, because we have the best damn government in the world, as far as I'm concerned, at least as far as the structure of government, as the ability to participate in that government. The thing that we need to do more of, though, is to get people to participate. Like Tom Hartman always says at what does he say at the end of every show? Do you know?
Well,
he says democracy is a participatory – it's a participatory sport. Tag, you're it, right? That means you gotta play, okay? You got to participate. And if you don't participate, don't complain. But the more that people participate, I am very confident in the American people. I'm confident that if all of the American people participated, if we had full participation, 100%, 95% of eligible voters in this country, if they voted and participated in their democracy – I am very confident we would have a better America. There's no question in my mind, because if you look at a lot of the polls, if you take any issue of the day, any issue, if you took gay marriage right now, if you looked at gay marriage and you polled that across the board, more people in this country are in favor of gay marriage than are not in favor of it, okay? And if all of those people participated in voting at the local level, the state level, the federal level, guess what? It wouldn't even be an issue. 50 states in this country would have marriage equality laws. But when you don't have full participation in your democracy, that's the missing link. That's the weak link that we have. It's not that the government's evil. Yeah, we know there's lobbyists. We know there's people scratching each other's back. We know there's, you know, just this obscene amount of money going through the political system. I get that. I understand all that. But I still believe in America. I still believe in this country. And I still believe that our best days are ahead of us, not behind us. And those days will come. Those days will definitely come, James, once we actually get Americans participating in democracy to the tune of 90% plus. So anyway, thank you so much for your call today.
Thank you.
All right, that's Dave calling in there from Chicago. I mean, but don't you agree, Eric? I mean, if we all participated, I mean, it's crazy how little participation we get, particularly in off – year elections.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could change a lot of things.
It would totally change the whole complexion of things, and that's the problem that we have, and that's the thing that C. Edmund Wright and conservative Republicans and libertarians just don't get. They always say, oh, if we could just get the government off of our back. Well, get who off your back? We are the government. The people are the government. You know, the government are like aliens. It's not like, what was that show with the pods and the seeds and the
Invasion of the Body
Snatchers. Yeah, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They act like government employees are like these like little pods that are being, you know, cultivated and nurtured somewhere.
The government has taken over their bodies.
Yeah, exactly. And that all government workers are nothing more than that. They're body snatchers. You know, they're just people who are not human beings. They're alien, and that they have no business in the business of the private sector. And that's just ridiculous, because people who do government jobs are your neighbors. They're your friends. They're your family members. They could be your parents, for crying out loud, okay? They're not aliens. They're part of we the people, okay? And the sooner conservative Republicans, the sooner that libertarians get that, the better off this country would be, because these are people providing great services, okay? Whether it's people working in the veterans' hospitals and providing care. What are you going to say, Eric?
I was going to say the IRS.
Now, well, you know, but guess what? You know, the IRS is not necessarily an evil entity, because you know what? There are a lot of corporations, like we just talked about, that don't pay taxes. There are a lot of corporations out there that offshore and take their assets and take their income and shield it such that they don't have to pay. So why should you, Eric Reiner, have to pay your taxes, but yet you have...
The NFL pays no taxes.
Yeah, well, this is the whole point, is that the IRS is just trying to do their job to make sure that everybody plays by the rules, plays fairly, and that if you have income and there's a certain tax rate, you pay your fair share, and so on. So I don't think that the IRS, or for that matter, I can't really think of any governmental agency in my mind's eye that is intrinsically evil or that intrinsically looking to just screw people. I mean, they're there for a reason, you know, whether it's the Department of Education. Boy, that's really bad, isn't it?
That's horrible.
That's horrible.
That.
Just really trying to get, you know, educate our citizens. And
let's dumb down everybody.
Yeah, but again, who wants to get rid of that?
The right wing.
The right wing. They want to get rid of the Department of Education, you know, another government bloated agency. You know, and what are they trying to do? Educate people. They want to get rid of, like, the Veterans Health Administration. When, why? Because these people, you know, put their blood and their limbs and their liberty and their freedom on the line for us in fighting wars or whatnot. And then when they come home sick with amputations, closed head injuries, they don't want to do anything for these people. You know, so you want to get rid of that agency too? You know, do you want to get rid of the Department of Defense? Of course not. That's the only thing. No way.
Let's give them some more money.
No, they're, you know, $400-500 billion a year, you know, of a big war machine. Well, we'll keep that one. But again, in essence, a Department of Defense is important, right? Of course it is. You know, there's evil people out there. You saw what happened with Hitler. He was one, you know, step away from world domination, and thank God we had a great military. Thank God we had a great Department of Defense to defend liberty and freedom. So the government does many wonderful things. You know, the research, the National Institutes of Health. Okay, me as a doctor, I mean, doing wonderful research. The government provided us the ability to actually sequence the entire human genome so that we can now use that DNA code and basically find out cures for diseases that otherwise could have probably never been possible had not the government did this. The private sector didn't do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check Tom out today at the Commonwealth Club, 595 Market Street, San Francisco, the crash of 2016. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get back to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let's go to Peter. Peter is listening on Free Speech TV in Fayetteville. I believe it's in Arkansas. So, Peter, welcome to the table.
Hey, Mr. Mike Newsom. It's a pleasure to speak with you, sir, and thank you. I really appreciate your enthusiasm here today.
Thank you. And I appreciate yours as well.
Well, I have a couple things as far as voting. If we can celebrate Christopher Columbus Day, I really think that we could trade that day in for any time you get the opportunity to vote,
mm-hmm.
be it at the local level or at the federal level. in that area, that's a day off.
Right.
A paid day off.
I'm 100% with you, Peter. First of all, I can't stand that holiday. That's the most ridiculous holiday that we have. I mean, this guy slaughtered Indians. They rape women.
If you really want to get Whitey on board, you trade Martin Luther King Day in for that day.
Well, I wouldn't trade that.
I'm just being specter. I don't mind me. I'm a cynic.
Yes.
But still, anyway. And honestly, jobs, I mean, the five-day work week, honestly, most people work a six-day work week. So if somebody gets sick, let them have 6 days off. That way they're going to get seven. And usually they can pass a cold or something like that in a seven-day period. So give them 6 days off.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, well, listen, I appreciate your call there. Thank you so much for calling in. And let's get to the other callers at 866-987-THOM. That's 866-987-8466. But I agree with them, Eric, about the Christopher Columbus holiday. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, if you want to read a really good piece on Christopher Columbus, go to Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn has a chapter in his book, The People's History of the United States of America, and he does a whole chapter on Christopher Columbus. And I read that chapter, and I just was I was incredulous. I could not believe the crap that went down with Christopher Columbus and when he came over here to America. I mean, over time, they practically made extinct certain of the Indian populations, and they just came and literally raped, pillaged, ravaged, stole, and pretty much it's not something we should be celebrating. I mean,
be proud of.
Yeah, I mean, that would be like saying, you know, let's have a slave day. You know, let's celebrate the heritage of, you know, American slavery and, you know, how great it was that plantation owners came and just
Slaver's Day.
Yeah, that's Slaver's Day. I mean, in essence, that's what you're doing. I mean, you're paying homage to a guy who pretty much enslaved people and tortured them and killed them and raped their women and stole their land and stole their goods. And, you know, it's horrible, absolutely horrible. I mean, one of the things that I've recommended in the past, I don't know if it ever take root, would be a Founding Fathers Day. Just replace Christopher Columbus Day with Founding Fathers, because one of my favorite people of all time, without question, is Benjamin Franklin.
Right.
And Benjamin Franklin, to me, is one of the greatest individuals of all time, let alone in American history. I think in world history, you have to put Benjamin Franklin, you know, I would think in the top, I don't know, top 10, top 25 of greatest individuals of all time, without question. But yet we don't honor Benjamin Franklin. And how could we be honoring Christopher Columbus versus Benjamin Franklin? Like, if you were to poll people, Eric, and you were to ask them who was more important to America, Benjamin Franklin or Christopher Columbus, what do you think most people would say?
Well, they'd say Christopher Columbus because he supposedly discovered America.
I don't think they would say that. I bet you the polls would almost universally give an overwhelming advantage to Benjamin Franklin.
I don't know.
You don't know?
We should try it out.
Try like a fake poll and see what happens?
Yes.
Yeah. But in any case, all right, let's get back to some of the callers here. Yes, get rid of Christopher Columbus.
It's not a fake poll. It's a real poll.
Well, but it won't be statistically accurate. But get rid of Christopher Columbus Day. Either put in a Founding Fathers Day, or I would be totally in favor of a voting day for Americans. You know, so Americans can take off. It would be a paid holiday. Everybody can go out there. You could participate. I mean, think about it. But you know what? I guarantee you, you know who's not going to want that? Conservative Republicans,
right,
and libertarians. They're not going to want that. Because they know if more and more people eventually participate in our democracy, the chances of them winning elections is probably not going to be what they would hope it would be. All right, let's get back here. Let's go to Steve, listening in Bloomington, Illinois. Steve has been holding for some time. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, that argument you were having earlier about central planning is what is known in logic as a false dilemma. And he's trying to frame it as if it's an either-or proposition. Either you have central planning completely or you have no central planning at all. In the top ten economies on this planet are all mixed economies. They have some of both. They have some planning. They have some social programs, but largely the market is free. Mm. Now, this is a big pet peeve of mine with libertarians and neocons in general, that they have this idea in their head, and I've heard the word ideology tossed around a lot lately, but nobody's talking about what the ideology is. Their belief system, which is what I like to refer to as the Ayn Rand thought virus, is the belief that individualism is an absolute, and therefore we, the people, are illegitimate.
Right.
And that's also another way of framing the false dilemma.
Right. No, but, you know, but the bottom line is this, is that, you know, the way I look at it, I'll get back to you as a doctor. What is the fundamental unit of life? It's the cell, right? The cell is like the individual, correct? But one cell in and of itself really can't really do much, can it? But when you put a bunch of cells together, guess what? You got a heart tissue. You put another bunch of different types of cells together, you got lung tissue. You put more neural cells together, you got a brain. And then you have all of those different individuals celebrating their individual diversity but working together collectively. What do you got then? Then you got one of the greatest things that we've ever known in the history of, you know, the universe, which is man, right? With man and women. You have the human body, the human being, because we all come from composite individual cells, each playing their different respective roles, but working together as we the people, right? We the people, you have the gift, the miracle called the human being. But if everybody existed as one individual cell, wouldn't be much fun, would it? All right. I think we lost him there. Anyway, we're going to the top of the hour. We'll be back. We still got a whole bunch of people. Norman, James, Mark, Donna, Jay, Michael, Mary, Johnny, Richard. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com, postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com and our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, hour number two. Dr. Mike sitting in today as Tom is crisscrossing the country promoting his new book, The Crash of 2016. He's in San Francisco today. I'm going to give you more details in another segment here, but we do have a special guest on the line. His name is Ian Millhiser, and he is the senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and also editor of Think Progress Justice. And he's going to be talking to us today about why the Senate Democrats had to invoke the nuclear option. And just so the listeners don't get worried right now, there's no nuclear war. There's nothing. We're not bombing Iran. We're nothing along those lines. So, Ian, without further ado, welcome on board.
It's great to be here. We are finally a democracy again.
Yeah, it sounds like it. We have to go nuclear.
Yeah, apparently that's what it takes to actually have the will of the people be carried out in this country.
Right, right. Well, listen, Ian, let's talk about this, because this is something that really has frustrated me for God knows how long. You know, the fact that we just have this stalemate consistently in the United States Senate, that you always need 60 votes now to get practically anything done. You know, the just grotesque use of the filibuster. Take us back a little bit before we get to what happened today through history. How did we get here? Because it wasn't always like this, correct?
That's right. You know, for most of American history, there just wasn't that much done to obstruct the confirmation of judges. Now, part of the reason for that is because lower court judges were basically patronage appointees, and they were selected by home state senators. In the Carter administration, that changed. And then really in the Clinton administration, you started to see this escalation where Senator Orrin Hatch, when he was chair of the Judiciary Committee, and others tried to put the brakes on some of President Clinton's nominees. And it's just escalated since then, with these lower court nominees becoming more and more contentious, until finally The current minority decided that they had the power to say, hey, there's this court over here. It's actually the second most powerful court in the country, the D.C. Circuit. Right now, we, the Republicans, control it. And if anyone else is confirmed, then the Democrats are going to control it. And this court is handing down a lot of decisions we like. So let's just refuse to confirm anyone to that court in order to maintain the Republican grasp on it. That's what this has been about. It's been about this question of whether a party that lost the last election can essentially nullify that result by preventing any of the things that the man who won the election is supposed to be able to do from happening.
Right, right. Now, is it not true, though, that every time you have a new Congress come in, the Senate leader, whoever it might be, in this case Harry Reid, have the opportunity to sort of change those rules and say, look, you know, you don't need 60 votes to just get cloture. Tell us about that.
Right. So there is one procedure that it stems from a constitutional rule that says that a past legislature isn't allowed to bind the future lawmakers. So, you know, Congress couldn't pass a law saying we are going to build a building here and this law can never be repealed. A subsequent Congress has to be able to repeal it. And so for that reason, the Senate has the opportunity to change its rules wholesale if it wants every 2 years. That's not the only way to do it. What happened today is they took advantage of a procedure that allows a majority of the Senate to make binding rulings binding rulings about the Senate's own rules. So a majority of the Senate voted that from here on out, for most confirmations, it's only going to require a majority vote. And that means you're not going to see these gains that we have seen, where the minority is trying to keep their control over courts, where in one case they tried to shut down the only agency that can enforce much of our labor law, which would mean that many workers would lose many of their rights in the workplace. You're not going to see that anymore. And the reason you're not going to see it is because, you know, from now on, if the nominee gets a majority of the votes, they go through.
So what was the vote on this? How did that pan out?
This was there were 52 votes of the 100 senators who voted to change the rule today. So there was a majority to change the vote, and that means from now on, a majority will be able to confirm people.
Right, and I assume they were all Democrats?
They were all Democrats. There were three Dems who defected. It was mostly older, more established Dems that defected, although not exclusively.
Who were they?
It was Pryor, it was Levin, who has been staunchly against this, and I apologize, the third senator is escaping me at the moment.
Okay, but we can look that up. So, yeah. But let me ask you this, though. I mean, look, I think it's a great first step, but from my perspective, from what you're telling me, is that this is a sort of a mini nuclear option, if you will, in the sense that it's very circumscribed and particular to just judicial nominees, correct?
Well, this is all nominees, executive and judicial, except for Supreme Court nominees.
Okay, but it does. Go ahead.
Okay, so in theory, you know, if Obama gets another Supreme Court appointment, you could see another attempt to block the nominee. I think that that's unlikely, though, and the reason why is because now that this norm has been established, that a majority of the senators can change the rules and prevent obstruction, that can be done over and over again. So that if they try to keep a Supreme Court nominee from going through, we can go right back to this method and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
All right, so let me ask you this then. Is the strategy here by the Majority Leader Harry Reid to say, look, enough is enough, and we're going to go nuclear here, but they're going nuclear in a very limited fashion for a very defined sort of a defined issue, in this case, nominees. What about other things, though? I mean, because still there's still the opportunity to filibuster whatever else is not defined under this agreement, correct? And that the Republicans in the minority can still basically hold the Senate hostage, which will logjam everything and not allow other – say if you had immigration reform, you're still going to need 60, right? Based off of this doesn't cover that.
That's right. So on legislation, what the Senate Democrats did today – It doesn't touch legislation. But in the short term, I don't think that that matters. And the reason why is because Republicans control the House. Mm-hmm. So on legislation, so long as John Boehner is king of the House, or, you know, Ted Cruz is king of the House, if you paid attention to the shutdown fight, what that means is that the Democrats aren't going to get anything through the Senate and aren't going to get anything through
the House
anyway,
right,
unless it has bipartisan support. Now, it will matter if, you know, 2 years from now we've had an election and Democrats control both houses and you have a Democratic president. In that case, then it will be important whether or not the rule is changed to affect legislation. And when someone decides to do that, again, it could be done with a simple majority vote. So I think the filibuster is on the way out.
Well, I would hope so. But let me ask you this, getting back to that immigration issue, because I know that's one of the next big things that the president wants to to tackle. And you mentioned bipartisan support, but when you look at the actual makeup of the Congress, bipartisan, I put that in quotation marks, because say every Democrat voted for something, then you would only need a small minority of Republicans to actually agree with it to get it to go through the House. So that's what I'm saying, is if you look at this immigration issue, there could be many vulnerable Republicans, if you will, in certain districts where the Latino population is prevalent, and they might want to, you know, kind of vote for sort of immigration reform. So in that case, wouldn't it be prudent to go nuclear, if you will, on maybe an issue by issue basis?
Right. So I don't know if it necessarily, like, I don't know if you necessarily need to do it on an issue to issue basis, because, I mean, you could do it that way. The thing that's important that was said today is it set a precedent.
Hold that thought, Ian. Hold that thought, because we're up against a break, and I want you to continue. Can you hang for one more second?
Sure thing.
All right. Okay, just hang out there. We're going to be back with Ian Millhiser, and we're going to continue the discussion. It's Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Crash of 2016, Tom's new book. Check it out at the finest bookstores across America. Okay, welcome back. We're here with Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst for the Center for American Progress Action Fund and also editor of Think Progress Justice. So, Ian, welcome back.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Good. Well, listen, let's get to the piece, because you did a very comprehensive piece today in Think Progress, and you talked about sort of this whole, you know, cloture issue and why Senate Democrats had to invoke the nuclear option. Give us a little sort of thumbnail sketch, if you will, an executive summary of what you wrote today, because you wrote a real interesting part about the National Labor Relations Board, and give our audience sort of a flavor of what happened and why this is important.
Sure thing. So the first big fight of this happened in July. And what happened in July is there's this agency, it's called the National Labor Relations Board. It's the only agency that can enforce a lot of rights for unionized workers and for workers who want to organize. And so if that agency doesn't exist, all of those rights cease to exist. And so what Senate Republicans got in their head to do is they were just going to refuse to confirm anyone to that agency, and if the agency doesn't have at least 3 board members, it's not allowed to do anything.
Doesn't have a quorum, right.
Exactly. So they're just going to wait it out until it was down to 2 people, and then they were going to be like, ha-ha, unions, you don't have any rights anymore. Workers, you don't have any right to organize anymore. And this was what the July fight that you might remember over the filibuster was mostly about. It was about making sure that the minority doesn't get to shut down an agency and repeal literally 80 years worth of rights that, rights that were signed into law in the Roosevelt administration.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they just don't like them. You know, the idea, they were claiming the power as the party that lost the presidential election and that lost the Senate election to veto something that FDR signed. That's what was at stake with this fight.
Right. And that wasn't the only thing that they've done with respect to the National Labor Relations Board. There are other things as well that they held up. Tell us about also some of the different courts that you mentioned in the article, as far as, you know, the courts of appeal and the District of Columbia and the circuit courts.
Sure. So the thing that triggered this fight was a court, it's called the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. It's the second most powerful court in the country. And the reason it's so powerful is because there's all of these powerful agencies that live in D.C., and many of the cases, many of the regulations that those agencies put out, many of the decisions they make can only be appealed to this D.C. Circuit Court. And so right now, conservatives have a lock on the court. The Republican judges have struck down environmental regs that would have saved tens of thousands of lives. They've cut off women's access to birth control. There was a decision they wrote where they said that employers have a constitutional right to keep workers ignorant of their rights.
Wow.
So this is a very, very conservative court. And if these three nominees are confirmed, then it will no longer be a court that's controlled by these very conservative judges. It will actually be controlled by Democratic appointees.
Right, and, the ones that Obama puts there, right.
Right, the ones that Obama puts in, the ones that Clinton put there before. And so, you know, the bottom line is that Senate Republicans like having the second most powerful court in the country, the court that reviews some of the most important regulatory issues that come up to any court, firmly in Republican hands, in control of some of the most conservative judges in the country. Now that the nuclear option's gone, they're not going to be able to prevent Obama's nominees from going through. And so what's going to happen is the decision that the American people made last November to put the choice of who's going to be on our courts in the hands of Democrats and not Republicans is actually going to mean something.
No, no doubt about it. You had even mentioned two particular judges in your piece, David Sentell and then Janice Rogers Brown, who believe that any kind of regulation, whether it's labor regulations, business, Wall Street, that they think it's constitutionally wrong. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, these are two incredibly radical judges. Like, if you go back in time 100 years, this was a period when the Supreme Court said that the minimum wage is unconstitutional, that attempts to, like, make sure that workers aren't overworked are unconstitutional, that at the federal level, child labor laws are unconstitutional. And these are two judges who look back at this period 100 years ago and say, that was great. Let's do that again. And those are, you know, two judges who have a tremendous amount, who have had a tremendous amount of impact on this very right-wing court. You know, I mentioned this decision limiting birth control that they recently decided.
Right.
Janice Rogers Brown wrote that opinion. So it's not like she's some fringe judge that writes crazy stuff and everyone ignores her. You know, she very frequently gets her way.
Yeah. What about the Supreme Court? Now, what is your opinion as far as who might be retiring next, who might be stepping down, and how soon – what is the time frame that we're looking at that?
Well, we have four justices right now who are over the age of 70, and Justice Ginsburg is 80.
Right.
So
– and she has the history of pancreatic cancer too, right?
She does. So, I mean, human frailty being what it is, a vacancy could come – up to four vacancies could come at any time. When that vacancy does come, you know, when Justice Sotomayor, who was not a controversial nominee, when she went through, Obama was at the peak of his popularity, and still there were only nine Republicans who voted for her.
Right.
Only three of those nine Republicans are still in the Senate.
Wow.
So that means that if Sotomayor were nominated today, there wouldn't be enough votes to break a filibuster, most likely, on her confirmation. And that is looming over the Supreme Court right now. If Justice Ginsburg steps down, or if, you know, Scalia leaves and suddenly there's a chance to flip the majority, without this nuclear option, I don't know that it would be possible for Barack Obama to confirm anyone to
right.
open seat on the Supreme
so
Court.
So do you feel that Senator Reid, if, say, tomorrow an opening were for whatever reason to occur for a Supreme Court nominee, would they – actually go nuclear again, because this doesn't, from what you were telling me, cover the Supreme Court nominees, correct?
Right. That's right. So this particular change doesn't cover it. But first of all, Democrats can, or whoever has the majority, can at any time invoke the nuclear option again and bring Supreme Court nominees under it. You know, the second point is that the Republicans are aware that Reid can do that at any time, and so hopefully they will stay their hand in the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. All right, well, listen, Ian, we got to run right now, so I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman Program and your calls in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Check out Tom's book, The Crash of 2016, and don't forget, tomorrow, Tom will be in Portland, Oregon at Powell's Bookstore. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike sitting in right now. The Freedom Lines are open at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. First up in the queue is Mary, listening on Free Speech TV from Spokane Valley, Washington. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad I finally got on. I'm a persistent American.
You're a patient. You're a patient American.
Well, patience, they may say it's a virtue. I say it's a way of life.
There you have it. So what's on your mind today, Mary?
I'm calling. It seems like you could touch on every base today that I have. I'm not a person to gripe.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like most people always have a reason to, like you said, complain about it, everything, but nobody's offering solutions.
Correct.
I'm an American citizen that looks for solutions. And in order to look for a solution for what is ailing our government, not that our government's bad, because it's just like a grapevine, you know, you start off with a mother plant and it, you produce all these babies and it creates a vineyard. Well, eventually, if the vineyard gets moldy, you have to go back to the mother plant and redo the whole orchard again. And that's kind of how I feel about our government and some of the ways that the government laws have been rewritten over the years since 1865.
Sure, sure. What are some of the things that you think we need to revisit or get back to the basics on?
Well, number one, everybody's with this Tea Party movement. Now, that's a crock-a-doodle if I ever heard it. If anybody knows anything about American history, it originally started with the molasses tax because us true Americans didn't want to go out without our booze, but the people that were more receptive to the British rule, they didn't join the battle and help support since they had the cash until the tea was taxed. So, of course, we have the Tea Party, and it's always been celebrated.
Right.
To me, the true movement in America should be the root of the law, which means to go back to what the root of the federal law jurisdiction meant before 1865,
right,
and the Gridiron Club of Washington, D.C., came into power in D.C. itself, you know, and on Capitol Hill, because from the time that they conceived the fact that they were going to create the corporation that they did, which was the Gridiron Club, which was created by the most irate business people and media groups.
Right, right. Well, let me do this. I don't want to cut you off, Mary, because we got a lot of callers right now, but I want to definitely get them in. And it sounds like there's a lot of history there. You're all the way back in the 1800s, and we're now 2013, so it might take more time to get all the way up to speed. So I do appreciate the call, though, without question. So let me get next to Johnny. I'm going to go to Johnny. He's in Lamar, Texas, and he might disagree with you, Mary, so I just wanted to get the contrarian side here on the Tom Hartman Program. Johnny, welcome.
Thank you. I wasn't paying attention to the previous caller, so I can't say yes or no whether I agree or disagree. But I do take issue with two remarks you made earlier in regards to our government. Actually, just what you said about our government, I have a comment about that and about our Christopher Columbus holiday.
Sure.
There's a lot to be desired the way we do things here. And I would like to see us incorporate a general philosophical attitude towards life the way the Norwegians do in terms of the way they punish their prisoners. I'd like to see us take a more proactive approach.
How do they punish their prisoners? I don't know that.
Like the Germans do. And I like the Italians' approach to people who become unemployed. They allow them a way to enter into a horizontal type cooperative business with their monies that they have set aside for them, along with some of their neighbors if they like. We don't do anything like that. None of that is formalized here at all. So speaking of the Italians, I would agree with you that I think we need to replace the Columbus Day holiday with something that commemorates the Italian spirit, just like we have St. Paddy's Day, because as far as I know, St. Paddy's was a pretty innocuous guy. He didn't write all kinds of evil things and talk about all the evil things he did with Native American children, putting them to sex.
Yeah, but St. Paddy's is not a national federal holiday.
Huh?
St. Paddy's Day is not a federal holiday.
Yeah, but as a nation, we do say celebrate St. Patrick's
Day. I know, but what I'm saying is as a federal holiday.
Or not, but we do celebrate it.
All right, well, I disagree with you on that. I think that actually St. Paddy's Day is fine, but it's not a federal holiday. Columbus is a federal holiday, and the discussion we were having was let's get rid of that as a federal holiday, Columbus Day, and let's put in a national voting day where people can get a paid day off, and then that will allow more people to participate in our democracy. And if we can't do that, then I suggested a Founding Fathers Day, a day to basically and mothers. We should make it Founding Fathers and Mothers, Eric, not just Founding Fathers. The Founders of Our Nation's Day, that would be better. That would be more comprehensive because many women played very critical roles in the early days of the founding of this nation. So it's not just the founding fathers. We can't neglect the founding mothers. But that's my opinion, and you might agree or disagree. Any case, 1-866-987-THOM is the number, 1-866-987-8466. Let's get back to some of the other people here. Let's go next to James. James, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico, wants to comment on the sick leave discussion we had a little bit earlier. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. Well, Mr. Wright is wrong. I'm sorry that Mayberry RFD is a fictional setting, and I don't trust anybody who uses that as an example of policy that works. I'm sorry, but Andy Griffith and, you know, the rest of the gang, they're all good folks, I'm sure, but fictional characters, not real. You know, if they can't come up with real examples to back up their arguments,
I wonder if he would have supported Andy Griffith's right to. Andy Griffith. Who was the guy who was gay and on that show? Gomer, right? Yeah, Gomer. Gomer actually. Yeah, he came out of the closet later on, and I just wonder if they would support.
Neighbors.
Oh, was it Jim Neighbors? Yeah, Jim Neighbors. He was Gomer on the show.
Actor, yeah.
So I wonder if they would have supported his right for marriage equality somewhere down the line as well.
Well, if it was still on the air, maybe so. I don't know, but
yeah.
I don't know, but now I'm going to violate my own rule and say this, that, you know, my two parents, they worked for the telephone company, and they didn't have a degree between them, but in their time, they were able to pay off not one, but two houses within 30 years.
Wow.
And CWA made that possible. And things like sick leave should be mandatory. Voting should be mandatory in this country. And again, if you don't vote, you ain't got no business complaining about anything, because that's the least that this country asks of you today.
And let me ask you one last question, James, before I let you go, too, because my thesis earlier was that, look, if more people did vote and if we had 100% participation in democracy, don't you think that would make our government a true reflection of the will of the people and make it a better democracy?
I agree with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
What's that?
No, I said it's not that the government's evil. I just think that we don't have full participation.
Exactly. No, too many people don't know how the government works or how it's supposed to work. And that's the way the people in power would like it, because then they can just tell them stories about Mayberry.
Right, right, exactly. No doubt about it. All right, listen, James, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, there you have it, James. I saw something on Facebook. I have it right here, too. This was interesting. Alvin Toffler. Hey, what just happened there? I just had something to do, and then it just, like, changed. Oh, there it is. It changed down. He says, good quote here, Eric. Listen to this. He goes, the illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. So I like that. I think that's kind of interesting, is that because that's what really life's about. As you evolve in your personalities, you become more experienced in life. It's really about what you know as your base, okay, your baseline knowledge, what you can garner from your previous experiences, and then as times change and you have to acclimate and you have to adapt, then guess what? Ultimately, if you can learn something new, unlearn what you learn, and then relearn, then you'll survive. And in essence, that's what the whole thesis of the survival of the fittest is. Charles Darwin said kind of almost the same thing what he's saying here, this Alvin Toffler. He paraphrased it, but Darwin said it's not the strongest, it's not the fittest that ultimately survive. It's those particular species that have the ability to adapt
yes.
to changes that makes you survive. And see, again, that really ultimately is the quintessential difference between conservatism and liberalism or progressivism, if you will, that liberals and progressives follow the laws of nature, of evolution, of Charles Darwin, in the sense that we know that times change, circumstances change, and that we adapt to those changes. Versus conservatives, they're kind of like the dinosaurs, in essence. They're extinct species because they really don't know how to adapt to changing times. They're very much set in their ways. They believe one thing. They don't believe in science. They don't believe in math. They don't believe that things change, and they think that everything is supposed to remain the same as it is today, as it was 2,000 years ago, as it was 5,000 years ago when they believed that the Earth was created and that we first came into existence. And that's the problem, Eric, that we face, is that they're very narrow-minded in that sense. And I don't say that disrespectfully. I say that sort of compassionately. I mean, I'd love to see my fellow human beings, you know, albeit conservative Republicans, kind of open their minds, eyes, and really understand that times are changing, science is changing, our understanding of ourselves as a species, our understanding of climate change and of the world community, all of that's changing, and we need to adapt. And if we don't adapt, then we will become extinct, just like the dinosaurs.
That lived only 6,500 years ago.
Exactly. And they're in museums, too. You can go check them out, actually. All right, listen, 45 minutes after the hour, back with more of the Tom Hartman Program in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Tom's book, The Crash of 2016, at the finest bookstores in America. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go first to Portland, Oregon. We were talking about Portland just not too long ago about the sick pay and the paid sick day leaves, but something else apparently happening out there that we're just being apprised of. So, Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so what's happening out there?
Well, it's not actually out here. It's in Colorado. I was in regards to the DEA is out there, again, destroying everyday American lives with their raids on the protection afforded citizens by the laws enacted by the citizens in that state. And I just don't understand how the DEA is going to continue to practice this prohibition of cannabis, which is a superfood, fiber, and fuel. And just like you were saying about cells, if you take one of them, it's not going to make a complete person. Why are we taking cells afforded us in nature that is substance, such as the food and the fuel aspect and the fiber aspect associated with hemp, and making it illegal?
And we
as taxpayers have to foot the bill for it.
Well, first off, Mike, you know, as a physician, you know, I can assure you that there are definitely medicinal purposes for marijuana without question. And we see it in medicine. We see it with people who have emaciation. They can't eat. They suffer from cancer. And the medical cannabis clearly helps with appetite stimulation. It clearly helps with nausea, intractable nausea. I mean, there are many good medical benefits from it. But even from that perspective, just from a recreational personal liberty kind of use, you're seeing things change throughout the country. I mean, obviously, state by state by state, municipality, you're seeing more and more people say, look, enough is enough. You know, we've legalized nicotine. We've legalized alcohol. Are you kidding me? We can't have marijuana legalized as well. And the citizens are going to the ballot boxes and making it happen. Now, what you're telling me, obviously, there was a statewide initiative in Colorado, and I have not heard of anything yet because I've been doing the show. But is there something ongoing today with respect to the Drug Enforcement Agency raiding dispensaries in Colorado as we speak? Or are you saying that this is something that they're doing sporadically, or is this something that's happening right now as you and I are speaking live on the air?
Right now, today, as we speak, they're raiding the patient's facilities access to cannabis.
Really?
And, yeah, it's the same premise as people used to tell Columbus, which, you know, Columbus Day, we might as well call it Hitler Day. Back in the day, he would sail off the edge of the earth. I mean, the government is taking the standpoint on this subject matter similar to people back in the day may have taken about whether the world was a sphere,
right,
or if it was actually flat. I mean,
but it was my understanding that the Obama administration and the Department of Justice were taking pretty much a hands-off approach, that if the citizens, state by state, municipality by municipality, were voting in to legalize use of recreational marijuana and not make it a crime, it sounds as though that, from what you're telling me, that the Eric Holder and President Obama are now sort of part and parcel of these raids, because obviously the DEA is part of the government and it's a governmental agency. So, look, we're going to have to check that out, Mike, but I do appreciate you alerting us to that. So thanks so much for your comments, okay?
Thank you. Yep.
Thank you. All right. So, Eric, you can get that checked out there and get some of the interns looking
at it. It's true. I'm looking at it.
It's happening right now. Wow. That's big news, though, because, you know, look, this is going to come to a critical point, because right now you have more and more states saying, look, it's legal from our perspective. You've got the federal government saying it's not legal. And just like prohibition and whatnot, it's going to come to a head at some point where the federal government is going to have to step in and say, look, either it's legal or it's not legal, because
when are they going to learn? I don't get it. You can make so much money off this, you know?
Yeah, taxes. I don't get it either, to be honest with you. I you know, again, speaking as a doctor, I have to say that I see alcohol and nicotine having much more deleterious effects on people's health. I mean, if you look at, you know, disease, I mean, just look at chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD from cigarette smoking, lung cancer from cigarette smoking, liver disease from alcoholism, not to mention the incredible amount of accidents that happen from drunk driving and all the bodily harm that that does. I mean, honestly, and I've searched the literature, I don't know of any literature per se when it comes to marijuana that can support the devastation that's wreaked by alcohol and nicotine that's comparable to marijuana use. And so I try to be objective about it just as a scientist. I consider myself a scientist, and I just don't see the reasoning behind why one is illegal, i.e. cannabis, but nicotine and alcohol are completely legal and completely, you know, alcohol, you see advertised
so
everywhere.
Alcohol's the worst.
I mean, you know, you see all these commercials, Coors Light, a big train coming through, you know, and, you know, beautiful women dancing around and guys kind of buddying up to one another. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, I mean, you can make commercials like that for marijuana, I'm sure, and then they'd probably be a lot more enjoyable to watch, too.
Jack in the Box has some.
Jack in the Box has some, right? It's just
have you seen those?
It's undercover. Oh, no, they actually have.
They have a late night munchies box, and they have a commercial for it. It's pretty funny.
Oh, but it's not anything to do with marijuana other than the munchies.
No, they had just watch.
Code word. All right, I'll have to watch it. But anyway, well, hopefully, look, times are changing, and I think that'll change, you know, over time as well. But to hear that DEA agents are actually raiding statewide voter-approved dispensaries is disturbing to me. I mean, I would have to say that is quite disturbing. All right, well, listen, we're coming up on the break right here, right now, and we still got a whole bunch of people on the line. We got Paul calling in from Woodinville, Washington. We got Doug. We got Andrea. Surfer John from Santa Cruz, California. He's on the line right now. Donna. We got Jay from San Saba, Texas. We got Imperial Beach, California. Michael, people from all over the country. We're going to get to your calls, but I also want to alert the listening audience that at the top of the next hour, we do have a very special guest and somebody who's actually exhibiting a lot of courage, Eric, to come on the Tom Hartman program live. And I want listeners to stay tuned for that. His name is Pastor Frank Schaefer, and he is a suspended pastor. He is now under a 30-day period whereby he has to repent for his sins. And if he does not repent for his sins, he will be defrocked as a pastor. He's a pastor with the Zion United Methodist Church of Iona, Pennsylvania, my home state. And I just think it's pretty sad that this guy is being...
How do they know if he repented or not?
Well, I guess he has to publicly go before... Not publicly or privately, go before his church and repent and be sincere about it. And then if they feel that he has repented to their satisfaction, then he won't get defrocked, and he can defrock, and he will still be a pastor. So he's coming up at the top of the next hour, so definitely stay tuned for that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today. Tom doing his book tour. We're going to be giving you some more details about where and when he'll be so you can get to meet Tom personally and get a signed copy of his book. But we also have a very special guest on the line right now, and this is a very important issue. And his name is Reverend Frank Schaefer, and Frank is part of the Reverend Schaefer is part of the United Methodist Church, and recently had performed a ceremony, a marriage ceremony, and because of what he did, he is now in the crosshairs of the church itself, and I'll let him tell you his story personally. So without further ado, Reverend Schaefer, thank you for coming on the Tom Hartmann Program today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, actually, the ceremony you're talking about was a ceremony for my son, for my gay son, and it happened a long time ago. It happened more than 6 years ago. And it was just recently brought up to charges. If you are willing to listen to the whole story, it actually all started with our son coming out as gay in 2000, in the year 2000. And the circumstances of that was unique. I actually received an anonymous phone call in my church office one day. A lady told me that I needed to know that my son was gay and that he was considering suicide. I was in shock at first when I heard that. I just couldn't imagine my son was gay, actually. And so when I hung up, I went home. I talked to my wife about it, and we decided we must talk to him. And so as we asked our son Tim, you know, are you gay? He came out and said, yes, I am. And we asked him about the suicide, and he said, yes, at one point he was considering suicide because he was crying himself to sleep at one time, praying to God to make him, quote-unquote, normal, to take, you know, this away from him. And when that didn't happen, he thought that it'd be better for him to be gone, you know, so that he wouldn't bring shame on his family and his community. When we heard that, of course, we were in tears, and we just hugged him. We told him, we love you, son. And obviously we said, this was not your choice. You did not choose to be homosexual. And so we affirmed him from that day on. We said things like, you know, look, you are created the way you are. This is how God intended you to be. You're beautiful in the eyes of God. You are created in the image of God, just like everybody else. So when he asked me in 2006 if I would preside over his marriage to another man, I felt honored, first of all, and then I was full of joy, and you know, that he would ask me, and I said, absolutely, son, absolutely, I will do that. And you know, that shortly after that is when I thought about what that meant for myself, for my career. I remember being willing to sacrifice my career over my love for my son at the time. So I actually wrote in my clergy profile that year an announcement to my bishop and the cabinet, which means all the district superintendents, that I had committed to performing a same-sex marriage, and that this was the marriage of my son in April of 2007. Now, I didn't hear anybody stopping me. Nobody contacted me. I wasn't stopped from doing it. So we did the ceremony 300 miles away from my church in Pennsylvania. We did it in Massachusetts, where same-sex marriage was legal at the time already, in a restaurant. And it was a joyful, very private family moment. There was no announcement made. I never actually told my church, anybody in my church, about it. I decided to, you know, to keep it quiet because I knew it was a very conservative context in my town here in Lebanon, as well as the church. And so I wanted to be the best pastor that I could be, and for this church in this context. And so, you know, I chose not to talk about it. And the whole thing came out this year in April. Somebody found out in my congregation and filed a complaint against me, and that's when it all came out into the open.
Okay, and then, so what happens then, Reverend Schaefer? Do you prefer Reverend Schaefer or Pastor Schaefer?
If you want to call me Pastor Frank, that's what I usually go by.
Go with Pastor Frank. They call me Dr. Mike, so Pastor Frank sounds more in keeping with the show. But in any case, Pastor Frank, and first of all, let me tell you, when you were telling that story, I'm going to make a confession to you live on the airways. I was teary-eyed. I mean, I was teary-eyed by the love for your son, and to have that courage and to go out there in that joyful moment and do what was not expected of you. I was very touched by that. And when you said that you were willing to sacrifice your career because of the love of your son, it did make me think of Jesus, because isn't that what Jesus did? Didn't he sacrifice himself so that, you know, we all could love one another?
Well, actually, I would never compare myself to Jesus, but yes, in some aspect, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So in any case, so now you're with the United Methodist Church, and now you're brought up on these charges. So what happens in that sense? Do you go before a quorum? Do you go before the specific church leaders? And what happens in a case like that?
Well, it's actually interesting that in our judicial system in the United Methodist Church, there are parallels to a civil court or even a criminal court, because of the separation of church and state in our country. You know, churches have their own judicial system, and ours resembles a civil court very much so. We have a bishop who acts as a judge, and we have a prosecution, the counsel for the church. We have a defense, of course, you know, my defense team. And there's a jury, and the jury was made up of 13 of my peers, which meant they were all pastors in the United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So, and then according to what I saw in the article, that you now are suspended. So what does that mean, Pastor Frank, that you're suspended?
Yeah, that in itself is a very interesting story, because to be honest, I expected to be defrocked from the jury. When I told them in my last speech to them that they would have to know something, that if I was still a United Methodist minister tomorrow, that I would continue to minister to all people, no exception, that I was standing for and speaking for the LGBT community from now on. I could not go back to be a silent supporter. And I mentioned things like, you know, the hate speeches in our church have to stop. We have to stop treating people like secondary Christians, second class Christians, that are gay and lesbian in our church. I expected to be defrocked, because it was a moment of honesty. I wasn't, you know, trying to be rebellious or anything, but I just told them where I was in my journey, and that I saw this as a calling from God to speak for people that had been hurt and harmed, you know, by the church, like my son. When they came back after deliberations and told me that I was suspended, but that I had 30 days to make a decision, I was actually shocked, because in a sense they deferred their decision onto me and said, so we want you to think about this, and in 30 days you need to make a decision to either surrender your credentials or, you know, to embrace the discipline as a whole, meaning including those provisions that are saying that I will not marry as a United Methodist minister any gay people.
Okay, now let me ask you this, Pastor Frank, because I know we have to go to a break here, but we'd like to have you for one more segment to find out kind of what's going to happen here. But I want to find out from you, too, is there still an opportunity in this 30-day window for you to present your case to a jury of your peers?
No, this was it. That was the trial.
So that was the trial, and that's what was the verdict. All right, well, listen, we're going to come back. We got Pastor Frank Schaefer here with us right now, and he did a very courageous thing and a loving thing, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Back with Pastor Frank in just a moment. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting here today, and we are here with Pastor Frank Schaefer. Pastor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dr. Mike.
Thank you. Well, listen, right now, so you have that 30-day period. What is the final day of that 30-day suspension, that period of reflection where you have to tell them one way or the other what course you're going to move in?
Well, that would be December 18th, I believe, and I will have to come up with an answer. Now, I think that that decision by the jury was actually brilliant, to be honest with you. I think they were aware of the fact that the eyes of the world were resting on them to see what they would do, not just the Methodist world, but literally the world, because this had been publicized quite a bit ahead of the trial. Mm-hmm. So I think they made this decision to basically put the ball in my court, because it looks much better for the church, first of all. And I am honored, actually, in a sense, because they trusted me in this decision to make a decision based on my conscience. They knew from my testimony that I do have strong convictions, and so they figured that at the end of the time of those 30 days that I would just have to surrender my credentials to the church based on my convictions, and they're probably not wrong. So,
right. Well, but you could also look at it from the perspective, perhaps, Pastor, that maybe there are some in that jury that support you, and maybe they feel that that 30-day window versus just issuing a verdict right then and defrocking you gives you an opportunity to sort of evangelize and get your point out to the world about not treating people second-class citizens or second-class Christians, if you will.
That's a very interesting thought. That hadn't occurred to me, so thanks for sharing that with me. But that's very true. And so the decision I will have to make is going to be probably one of the hardest decisions in my life, because honestly, I've been a part of the United Methodist Church for more than 20 years. I've been an ordained minister for 17, and I love this church, you know, except for this one provision. I really love this church. I've poured my heart and soul into this church, mm-hmm. and in service and ministry, and my children were baptized, all of them, all four children were baptized in the United Methodist Church, and you know, it's the tradition, the spiritual tradition that I have grown very fond of and that I'm steeped in. And so, mm-hmm. you know, to surrender my credentials will probably be the most difficult thing I've ever done.
Right. No doubt about it. Well, like I said, you know, I always try to look on the brighter side, and hopefully that jury themselves, because you sound like a man of great love and great compassion, and I'm sure that people, your peers, recognize that, and maybe that's why you got this 30-day window and give them time to reflect and the world community to reflect to see kind of where this goes. How is your son doing through all this?
I think he's holding up, although my wife always tells me almost every day, I think he's putting up a front that this is really bothering him more than he lets on. So I'm not sure how he feels exactly inside, but I was so proud of him when he took the stand at the trial, and when he shared his testimony and, you know, much of what I shared here earlier in the program. And when he talked about, you know, how he felt hurt and to a point where he, you know, cried himself to sleep, the whole room was so silent, and then all you heard after a while was sobbing, and I lost it too. I remember my attorney next to me just put his hand on my shoulder, you know, to console me. I was so proud of him. It was such a great moment that he shared this testimony with the world, or at least with the trial court.
Sure, no doubt about it. Look, we're all proud of you. I mean, you might not know this, but I'm proud of you. Tom is proud of you. I'm all of the listeners, Eric here, we're all proud of you because we need more of this, Pastor. We need people to stand up for love and equality in this society. And like you said, stop treating people as second-class Christians. I mean, from your perspective and your studying of Jesus, I mean, what did Jesus say about love and marriage from your perspective?
Well, for one thing, Jesus never mentioned homosexuality at all. So my point is about that. If it had been that important, why didn't he mention it? And Jesus was all about love. I mean, he never excluded anybody. He was so far ahead of his time. He empowered women, which wasn't common in first century Judea. He empowered the lepers. He let the lepers come and minister to them that were anathema to the rest of the people that were, you couldn't be touched. You know, he consorted with prostitutes, tax collectors, Samaritans, all those marginalized groups, and he never excluded anybody. Whoever came to him, he treated with respect and love, and I think we should all, you know, take our lesson from him.
Yeah, no doubt about it, Pastor. Well, I often tell people this story because I am an internal medicine physician, Pastor. I care for the elderly and also do a little bit of hospice end-of-life care as well. But, you know, I always tell people when I studied medicine, and not to get too biological here, but, you know, millions and millions and millions of sperm go for one egg, and it's that one sperm that gets there first that, you know, fertilizes the egg, and that if any of us came in second place, we wouldn't exist, right? So every one of us is a gold medal winner. And I look at that from God's eyes, too, that, you know, all of us, no matter who you are, who you love, what color your skin is, every one of us are miracles of life. Because if you come in second place, you don't get that gold medal, right? So we should treat people as such, as I guess.
I love that. Thank you for that analogy. That's beautiful.
Yeah, well, thank you, Pastor, for all you do. And you know, we're praying for you, and we hope that the end result of this is that, you know, love prevails and that more love will be out there in the world, in the universe. And we thank you for being a catalyst for change. It was very brave of you to take the stand. It was very brave of your son to come out and not only come out, but to profess his love for another man and consummate that love in the you know, in marriage. And we support you. We just want to let you know that myself and the Tom Hartman program, the millions of listeners that Tom has, we are behind you and we support you, and you are not alone in your struggle.
Thank you very, very much.
All right. Thank you, Pastor Frank. Okay. We're going to be back with more in a moment, so stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget about Tom's book, The Crash of 2016. Tomorrow he'll be in Portland, Oregon. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Dr. Mike sitting in here. We got the final half hour, so we're just going to go bareback. No more guests for the day, but a very special moment there with Pastor Frank Schaefer, Eric. I mean, I was very touched. I was teary-eyed when he was telling me that story about his son and how his son was suicidal and that he had found out sort of anonymously somewhat that his son was indeed gay. And then he confronted his son, if you will, and his son did not deny it. And his son also said that he was indeed suicidal because he did not want to bring shame to the family. I mean, that just breaks my heart that any individual has to live in fear of bringing shame upon one's family simply for the fact that you are who you are. And the fact that there is a segment of our society that would make an individual feel as such, to me, is very sad. It's very sad to think that there are people who, in the name of God, in the name of Christ, are saying that, you know what, you're second class, you're not worthy, you're subservient, you are not equal, just because you were born the way you were born. And that's offensive, Eric. I mean, could you?
Well, Mike, there are a lot of people out there like that.
No.
Unfortunately.
I know. I mean, what are they going to do next, conservatives? They're going to go after, like, kids with Down syndrome and say, you know, hey, you know, you're less worthy because you're not like us, you don't look like us, you don't think like us, and therefore, you know, you're second-class citizen. Is that what Sarah Palin is going to tell Trigg? You know, Trigg, you know, I wish you were created equally in God's eyes, but you're not, you know, and because of such, I'm not going to say your grandmother really love you because you're different. You know, that's not what Jesus was about. That's not what Christ is all about. And it's sad that, you know, people have to go through this. But, you know, kudos to Pastor Frank for standing up, you know, not only for his son, but for his own convictions and also for all of us, because indirectly he's representing we the people, at least many of the people that I know and love, who, you know, love homosexual, love all people, not just homosexuals. They love all people. They don't discriminate against people. So I'm going to open up the freedom lines here, and if anyone would like to kind of dovetail into this or talk about this, let's do that. The number is 866-987-THOM. Again, it's 866-987-8466. And Pastor Frank has till, I think he said, December 8th to make his final decision. I think we all know what his final decision is going to be. But the question is, will the church repent, Eric? Will the church repent for what they're putting this guy through and allow him to continue his ministry, allow him to continue to serve others in the name of our Lord and in the name of Jesus and in love and kindness and compassion? Doesn't sound like it from what he's saying, but hey, you never know when someone's going to be touched by the Spirit, right? So maybe the church will be born again itself. All right, let's go to Rob. Rob is on the line from New York, New York. He's on WWRL, and he actually has been following Pastor Frank's work for quite some time. So, Rob, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Dr. Mike, it's not that I've been following his work all along, but I hope I have the right person, because there is a book written called Crazy for God. Mm-hmm. Frank Schaefer, who is a pastor. I'm a gay man, so I was interested in reading this book because this was the beginning. He and his father were the founder of the evangelical movement, the religious right, all this about, you know, abortion, et cetera. They were the ones that started all of this. Mm-hmm. So I hope I got the right person, because in this picture of him, he's much younger, so he's an older guy now. So I was just wondering about that. I think it's the same person.
Yeah, it very well might be. But what did you think about what you heard today on the air?
Well, I have to tell you, after I hung up from your screener, the only thing, when did he say he married his son?
He married his son in 2006 is when he married him. Then I think he also had mentioned.
He said, now, you know, I don't want to, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, because, you know, I'm a gay man.
Right.
But it seems to me he kept that wedding rather quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And the church found out about it.
Correct.
And they were probably angry that, you know, that he kept it quiet. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying this is, you know, right by any means, that the church, you know, wants to, you know, get rid of him. But I'm just saying that, you know, he kept it kind of quiet, and, you know, it was also probably because he didn't want to lose his job.
Well, but it may be, but also, Rob, in defense to the pastor, you know, it's a private ceremony. I mean, if you marry someone, you have no obligation or right to go out there and say, you know, who you married, when you did it, and he also did it out of state. It wasn't even in the jurisdiction, if you will, of where he lived.
Yeah, that's right. I understand that, but you know, you can look at the other alternative to that. I'm not saying that the you know, I'm with the pastor all the way about his son getting married. Don't get me wrong. It was just an afterthought I had after I hung up from the screener, because I thought, well, yeah, you know, he wanted to keep it kind of quiet. And
well,
so he went out of state to do it.
Well, maybe. Well, I think, but I think he went out of state because, as he said, that marriage was legal there in Massachusetts, and it wasn't legal in it isn't legal. I'm from Pennsylvania. It's not legal in Pennsylvania where he administers, you know, where he works as a pastor. So he wanted to not only obviously confirm his son's love and through the institution of marriage, but he wanted to make sure it was legal, and that's why they went to Massachusetts. All right, listen, Rob, I got others on the line. Appreciate the call. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, that's let's opening up another Freedom Line at 866-987-THOM. Again, 866-987-8466 is the number. Let's go to Harry. He's listening in Providence, Rhode Island on Free Speech TV. He also wants to weigh in with his thoughts on the pastor as well. Harry, welcome.
Thank you. Dr. Mike, I wanted to affirm Pastor Frank and what he's doing. I'm a Methodist and I'm a minister, though not pastoring a church currently. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the Bible, how the Bible is written about gays. And there was nothing in either the Old or the New Testament, I've written several articles on this, mm-hmm. that were dealing with people who who knew themselves to be gay, there were things written, particularly in the Old Testament, about, you know, a man who lies with a man, for example.
Yeah, Leviticus.
There's not even mention of lesbianism at all in the Bible. And, you know, we need to have a proper understanding of the scriptures rather than just assume that our biases, based on the biases of others for the last couple of generations,
right,
are really accurate, because they're not.
Well, and you're right, because there's nothing mentioned in the Bible about any of those things, whether it's gay or lesbian. And hey, look, who knows? Maybe Jesus, and I'm not saying this kind of just to create controversy, maybe Jesus was gay. I mean, Jesus hung out with 12 guys, you know, all the time. You know, he, who knows? Do we know that for sure?
We really don't know.
We don't know that, do we?
The orientation of many, many characters in the Bible.
Right.
And it's been suggested that perhaps David and his love for Jonathan, there's clearly very intimate feelings expressed. It
right.
could well be that David and Jonathan were gay.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So, but the same point with Jesus. You don't know what Jesus was, right? He never had a girlfriend. He never had a boyfriend. You don't know. There's nothing in the Bible that says what Jesus's sexual orientation was. You have no clue.
And it's true.
No one's ever asked that question.
Another thing, Dr. Mike, people assume that because sodomy comes from the word, Sodom, that this was, you know, a castigation of the Bible against all gays, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
What the sin of Sodom was that, it rejected the guests instead of offering the hospitality that's a hallmark even to this day of Middle Eastern cultures. And Jesus spoke about that when he spoke of Sodom and said that their sin was not being welcoming.
Right.
We need to understand the background of the scriptures so that, and hospitality in this case.
Right.
So we don't have the prejudice that's come down to us in recent years.
No, well said. Well said, Harry. So listen, I thank you so much for calling in from Providence, Rhode Island, and, point well taken.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. God bless you.
God bless you, too. All right, there you have it. Well said. Okay, let's go next to Tony. Tony's in Riverside, California, listening on Free Speech TV. Tony, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
I just wanted to say that I applaud Pastor Schaefer. His choice is reminiscent of a choice I had to make many years ago. I was the head of a breakaway group from the Mormon Church, and what was really beautiful in listening to his story was the fact that our first congregation in Los Angeles rented a facility from the United Methodist Church of the Los Feliz United Methodist Church in Los Angeles. They were very good to us then. And when I heard his story, having to go out of state because of the laws as they are in various states, I applaud him and I applaud what his son was doing. And I just hope that other congregations find his worth as a pastor so that he can continue his ministry.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Tony, thank you so much for your heartfelt words endorsing love and compassion and tolerance, and we need more of that in the world. So thank you so much. All right, there you have it. It's Tony from Riverside, California, opening up another Freedom Line right now as the Freedom Express pulls up to its final stop, its final destination for today. Don't forget about Tom's book, The Crash of 2016. We'll be back with your calls in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Tom tomorrow, 7:30 p.m. at Powell's Bookstore, 1005 West Burnside Street, Portland, Oregon. Okay, welcome back to the final segment for today. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Tom's out there on tour promoting his book, The Crash of 2016. We'll be here tomorrow as well, so look forward to that on Friday. But in the interim, this is the final segment for today, so I want to get as many callers in as possible. So let's go first to Tim online, listening in Seattle, Washington. Tim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, I don't think you can hear me.
Oh, I can hear you.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes, I actually know what you're thinking, too.
That's good, because I don't.
Yes, exactly.
I was ordained a Presbyterian minister, which is pretty similar to Methodist, and I served the church for 5 years, and then I worked for the Unitarian Universalist in a congregation in Boston. And I just wanted to give you some inside information on what's going on politically.
Yes.
With the Methodist. In a general way, the pastor is not able to say this, but what would help him would be if the American people, especially Methodists, but, you know, if everyone put pressure on the Methodist church to change their whole policy, that's the only thing that's going to keep him in his job. Mm-hmm. And eventually they are going to change. There's no question about it. The Presbyterians are changing quickly. The UCC church, the United Church of Christ, has already changed. Of course, the Unitarians have changed. They're all ordaining or beginning to ordain gays.
Right.
And it's just a matter of history is on our side, and this fellow is caught up in that tipping point in the gray area, and we can help. And they're going, you know, they're going to change.
Yeah, so I would hope so.
That to happen quickly.
Well, I would hope so.
About it.
Well,
all the mainstream denominations are going to ordain gays sooner or later, and it might be able to be sooner because they're losing members like crazy.
Right. No, I agree with you. I hope that happens. I hope it happens, and I support that. So thank you so much for calling in, Tim. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, that's Tim. Sound like you knew what he was thinking.
Yeah, you didn't have to do it for him, Mike.
Yeah. Well, actually, I did do it for him. I just spoke in his voice. There you have it. Just like in The Exorcist. I saw that on the other night, speaking of religion.
Did you watch it?
Yes, it's pretty freaky. Linda Blair and...
It's kind of cheesy now. Back in the day, it was freaky.
I don't think it's cheesy. I still think it's pretty scary. I mean, when she turns around and like, yeah, mother... Rah, 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 rah.
Yeah, watch the language.
No, I didn't say it. I mean, but, you know, and then she started puking all over the place. And it was late at night, too, when you're supposed to watch those movies. I was all alone and just watching it.
Okay, thanks for that story.
And then I realized afterwards, too, that when it came out, it was like, what, 1977 or something like that?
70s, yeah. Late
I think 70s. It was 77. But then I just finally realized after all these years, it was a Jesuit priest who actually came in to try to do the exorcism. And I was trained by Jesuits.
Damn me.
Yeah, I didn't know that, right? When he speaks like his mother and stuff. Yeah, so little did I know that I have the background maybe to perform an exorcism. I don't know.
No, but I am a reverend.
Are you a reverend?
Yes, I am.
You're irreverent.
Universal Life Church.
Yeah, you're irreverent is what you are. So, but and
I got my certificate online.
Did you? You can get it. Can you get a reverend degree
really
online?
I really am an ordained minister from the Universal Life Church.
Oh, very nice. All right. And do you have universal whole life insurance too?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, in any case, let's get back to some of the other calls, see what they have to say. Let's go to Mike, listening on Free Speech TV. He has a story to tell us as well. Mike, welcome.
Yeah, hi. You know, the story with the pastor kind of touched upon a story a few years ago. There's a young man that, a few doors down from me. He was gay. His parents knew it and everything, but he had been struggling with it for some time. And, to everyone's surprise, he, did end up committing suicide. But my bigger point to the issue of that is that when I went to the service and everything, the church was full, door to door, over 500 people.
Wow.
And I think it's something important for these people to realize that, and he was in his young 20s.
Wow.
That they need to realize that they touch a lot of lives. And they're important to a lot of people, whether they seem to be having problems with their identity at that time, that, you know, they need to know that. And I'm not sure if they, you know, not saying that these people didn't let them know, but it was a great, there was a great eulogy by one of his friends, and stuff like that. It was just something that was very, very touching. It was very sad because, I mean, I knew him. I mean, he watched my house and when I went on vacation and took care of my pets too and stuff like that. So
wow.
He was a good guy. And he, when you think about when I went there, I was just totally in awe of how many people were there.
Right. expressing their sadness of the loss of him.
This guy had, right, in less than a quarter century, he touched over 500 lives.
Right, and that's just the people who could make it that day, too. There's probably a lot more, too.
Right.
So, all right, well, listen, Mike, I appreciate you sharing that story with us. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to get probably one last call in here. Let's go to Charlotte. Charlotte says there's evidence that there are lesbians in the Bible. Charlotte.
Hi, how are you? And it's Charlotte. But,
Charlotte.
It's Charlotte. It's a little too, yes, Charlotte. And, you know, I'm not against, you know, gays in any kind of way, but I think I just wanted to clarify something from the ministers that there's no reference to lesbians in the Bible, but there actually is a reference to lesbians in the Bible, and it's in Romans, actually.
In Romans?
So in Romans. And let me see if I can look it up real quick.
All right. Well, listen, I don't have time for you to look it up on the thing, so I'm going to go to somebody else. While you're looking up something in the Bible, I'm going to go to an atheist. All right. Hello, Atheist Tim.
Yes, hi. You know, I don't want to talk too much about what atheism is, but it's essentially the non-belief in a God. But more to the point that with religion, these sort of things happen and they're tied directly to that religion. The Bible, so forth, has slavery, has all this different horrible things. And people need to understand that you can have a great life without these sort of superstitions.
All right, well, there you have it. You got the last word, Tim, the atheist, and also saying that you can experience love and compassion even without a God. So there you have it. Great show today. Thank everybody for participating. Tomorrow we'll be back sitting in the seat for Tom again as Tom goes across the country on his book tour, The Crash of 2016. We'll probably have a little bit of Anything Goes Friday tomorrow, so definitely get in queue. Give us a call tomorrow, and we'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.